This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. By the end of this week, North Carolina will most likely have a budget for the next 2 years, and a tumultuous General Assembly session will be at its end. Following the passage of a tax reform package last week, lawmakers released details of a proposed budget. It contains dramatic cuts to public education, including an end for teacher tenure, a reduction in funding for teacher assistants, and an increase in tuition at community colleges. Also in the legislation, compensation for victims of the state's eugenics program and an end of funding for the controversial Rural Center. Here to unpack the details of the budget, WUNC Raleigh Bureau Chief Dave DeWitt. Hello, Dave.
Hi, Frank.
Let's start with education. Talk about the changes this budget will bring.
Well, there are a lot of them. As you mentioned, some of them, taken individually, you take a opportunity scholarship or a voucher bill, you take the 1% raise in the last 5 years for teachers, no money in the budget for raises this year. The teacher tenure being removed, removing the cap on class size, not funding the teaching fellows program again this year, taking it individually. Those would be big changes to education in any session, but you put them all together and it really is a fundamental shift in how not only education is funded, public education is funded in this state, but really how it's viewed by this state legislature. These are things that a lot of Republicans have wanted to do for some time, and now they have the opportunity to do it without a threat of veto from the governor, so they're going to do it, and it's going to make a big difference. It's not only going to be sort of felt by teachers and school administrators, but this one will be felt by students and families as well.
Well, let's see what happens in the classroom. A couple of elements of the legislation. Teacher assistants, about a 21% cut in funding for teacher assistants, and removing the cap to class size. So what impact is that going to have on classrooms across the state?
Well, it will have a significant impact on second and third grade classrooms in particular. The budget as it is will protect teacher assistants and likely school administrators will keep teacher assistants in the kindergarten and first grade. But second and third grades will probably lose their teacher assistants in many of the school districts across the state. You mentioned the 20% cut or so to teacher assistants. That translates to somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000 jobs across the state for teacher assistants. And teacher assistants do a lot in classrooms. Oftentimes they do small group instruction. They do all kinds of activities as directed by the teacher, administrative things within the classroom, really another set of ears and eyes in a classroom. And that's important. Ask any teacher, especially ask any teacher assistant, especially at that age, it's hard to keep an eye on everything, especially now when the caps on class size will be removed and you'll see larger classes. Now, this will play out differently in different districts across the state. Some districts will work really hard to keep small class sizes, particularly in the lower elementary grades. But class sizes will undoubtedly get a little bit larger as the years go along.
Right. And in effect, taking that teacher assistant out raises the class size because you remove one adult and it puts more responsibility on the remaining teacher.
Absolutely.
Talk about an end to teacher tenure, the impact on that, and there's a bit of a trade-off on that.
There is. Teacher tenure, and people hear that word tenure, and in this case it doesn't apply in the traditional sense because, of course, teachers here in North Carolina cannot collectively bargain. Tenure is a job protection, but it's not a very strong one in this state. Teachers can still be fired for any number of reasons, whether they're good or not good teachers, whether they have done something in a classroom that would necessitate them being fired. That is still a fairly easy thing to do in the state. So removing teacher tenure will have an impact for sure. There will be a lot less protection for teachers. The bigger thing is really, though, moving to this system of multi-year contracts, 1 to 4 year contracts, and then the merit-based, both pay and merit-based contract system that will be implemented. Now, how that system will be implemented, we don't know the details yet about how that's all going to work out. But the best teachers would be welcomed with bigger contracts and more money in theory. But even if you look at how much money has been budgeted for that and even the best teacher, if you collect a certain number of those teachers, and you're looking at about $400, $500 a year maximum, really, for a salary increase for the best teachers. And they might get 3 to 4 year contracts. Those teachers that are deemed not to be the best, and how that happens, how you deem those teachers not to be the best, whether it's test scores, you know, whether it's in-class observations, some combination of the two, those teachers will be put on shorter contracts, 1 year, maybe 2 year contracts. So that change will be significant, and teachers will feel that one.
And teacher pay has already slipped with respect to our neighbors, so we're not very competitive these days when it comes to attracting high quality teachers, if teacher pay is any measure, right?
Surely not. Yeah, the state is either 46th or 48th, depending on how you do the salaries for teachers, and it's below West Virginia, below South Carolina, a lot of our neighbors for sure. And another thing that will affect teachers' salaries, and this is a big one, especially if you ask teachers, no longer if they go get a master's degree will that become a salary bump? Will they increase their salary if they get a master's degree? Those teachers that have already gone and got advanced degrees will still have that salary increase. They're not going to take that salary away, but that removes a really big incentive for teachers to go learn more and you know, maybe get recertified in a different area. And it'll have a huge effect, really, on the schools of education in North Carolina on college campuses, because there are programs across the state, dozens of programs that are geared toward teachers going back, getting a master's degree in mid-career. So doing it at night, doing it on the weekends. So that will have a significant effect, not just on teachers and their opportunity to advance in their career and increase their salary, but that'll have a big effect on schools of education across the state.
Well, and sure, and if you have a master's, you wouldn't stay here. You'd have to get out of the state because you're going to get more money anywhere.
Right. And you're going to see, I think, you know, the competition for teachers as the years sort of get away from the Great Recession, so to speak, there's going to be more and more competition for teachers. And we saw that a couple of years ago before the recession. We saw teachers moving a lot, especially from the Midwest down here, because North Carolina was really making an effort to increase its teacher salaries. It got up into the middle ranking of states and a little bit above average. Now it's sunk back down, and so that competition will be harder to get back into, and so we're going to have some teacher shortages once we get away from sort of the economic problems we've had.
Ranked 23rd 6 years ago, now back down to 44th. So, okay, but lawmakers knew this going in. They had to have heard from teachers and other supporters or opponents of this legislation. They had to have heard about the correlation between class size and quality of education. They had to know we're going to become less competitive with our neighbors when it comes to attracting teachers, and yet they went ahead with this budget. So what do the supporters of this budget say about why they had to do this?
Well, different folks will tell you different things, and the sort of philosophies range somewhat from the people who believe that, you know, this is a state with a lot of poverty and there's just certain things you can pay for and certain things you can't pay for. And they believe that education can be streamlined and that there can be some savings that can occur. A lot of folks here will say, oh, you can save some money by going to some online education, improving technology and those things. And then there's sort of along the gradient, if you will, along the spectrum, there are folks who truly believe that education should be truly privatized and that students should be given a certain per pupil funding from the state, and they can take and do whatever they want with that. They can go to a private school, a charter school, a different kind of public school, and that if public schools are really going to improve, they've got to compete in the open marketplace. And you know, those folks are getting closer to what they want because it will be more of an open marketplace. We're seeing a lot of relaxing in the charter school rules. We're seeing money that is starting to go to students. We've seen that with these so-called opportunity scholarships for low-income families and for students with disabilities. So it really is creating more of an open marketplace in the school system. A lot of other states have tried this, and there have been mixed results to, I think, put a positive spin on it. So how this will go along, I think you're going to see more and more of this sort of marketplace-based education funding.
Well, tell us more about that. We know that there are a kind of a voucher program as part of this budget. Low-income students and some students with disabilities will get vouchers for private schools. How's it going to work?
Well, the students with disabilities who will get the vouchers, you know, that bill was debated openly on both floors, the Senate and the House. The one that is more of a true voucher that goes, this so-called opportunity scholarship that goes to low-income families, that one was never debated in either House or Senate here. That one was just included in the bill. And that's something that Senator, you know, Berger has really wanted for a long time. He's the Senate pro tem. That is going to make a significant difference. And if you talk to teachers, you know, after they talk about sort of the salary issues and some of the things that they're doing to the profession, that is the number one thing. Public school supporters are really concerned about that. They think that will take money away from public schools. There's a $10 million cap that on those vouchers to start with, and a sort of corresponding $11 million cut to the public schools. The thought being that there will be a lot of students who take this and then go, and so there will be less funding needed for the public schools.
So less funding for public instruction, public school instruction, more funding toward privatization. So we can see this push toward privatization. And as you said, Senator Berger was pushing for that, for this voucher program. Tom Tillis got something he wanted, and that is funding for the victims, repayment for victims of the eugenics program. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is something he's tried to do for a couple of years. He tried to do it last year with then-Governor Perdue's support. It stalled in the Senate. It was known to be a bargaining chip when Berger and Tillis went in behind closed doors and their lieutenants and started hashing out the budget. And this is something he got. He really wanted it. It's $10 million. It will cover $50,000 per victim. That goes to only about 200 people. So it's not a lot of money. $50,000 for being victimized by this program seems like not a lot of money. And if more victims come forward, that will be even less per victim. But it is something. And no other state has done this. They've gone given money to eugenics program victims. It is something that Tom Tillis really wanted, and he got it.
On the State of Things today, we are talking about the state budget, the proposed budget that is about to be approved, no doubt, this week. WUNC Raleigh Bureau Chief Dave DeWitt is with us, and we will continue our conversation on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, talking about the North Carolina proposed budget, with us WUNC Raleigh Bureau Chief Dave DeWitt. And joining us now is Becky Gray, Vice President for Outreach at the John Locke Foundation. And Tazra Mitchell is a fellow at North Carolina's Justice Center's Budget and Tax Center. Welcome to both of you. Good to have you on the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Becky, let's get an overview. What do you think of this budget?
I think it's a very good budget. There's some themes that go through this, I think, Frank. You know, anytime we have a budget, it really starts with ideas, priorities, sets a lot of policy for the state. Then it sets up a framework in order to make that, put that policy into place. And we see a real direction that the General Assembly and the administration wants to take the state. So, you know, we've talked and heard a lot in the last couple of days. We're going to be hearing more about details and specific pieces of it. But overall, that's what we see with the budget. And with this budget, I think there are a couple of things. I think we're seeing a focus on limited government. I think we're seeing a focus on better management, cost containment, fixing stuff, if you will, and then a new focus on accountability and measures with taxpayer money. And, you know, limited government, we have a 2.3% growth in this budget. There are no new taxes. There is no new debt. They're actually, with tax reform, you know, as we're seeing phased in, there will be a reduction in taxes in North Carolina. So, again, limited, smaller government. We're also seeing better management. The Rural Economic Development Center was mentioned earlier. That's one where they've gone in, they've identified a problem, they've attacked it, they've withdrawn the funding, redirected the funding in a different way, if you will. We certainly see that with Medicaid. You know, that's another area. There's framework set up within this budget to reorganize Medicaid. What we're learning is Medicaid and the problems and the lack of cost containment in Medicaid is in large part driving this whole budget. Until we get that under control, there's not going to be money for some of these other needs. We talked about education in the last segment. Until we get Medicaid under control. So again, fixing stuff, reorganizing, and then accountability. And we're seeing a lot of that. And that's another theme that runs across this. I think with the transportation equity funding formula that we saw some changes in, some other legislation certainly followed through with this budget. With education, some of the measurements that we're putting into place with education, you know, it's 56% of this state budget. And so there's some real measures of some measures being put into place. Is that money being spent the best way that it can possibly be spent? Is there accountability to the folks paying the bills? And how are we going to ensure that those taxpayer dollars are spent the best way that they can be spent?
Talk about
ongoing
that framework. Tazra, what do you think of this budget?
I think that Becky is absolutely correct that budgets are legislators set their priorities through the budget. It's also a clear set of choices that are available to legislators. And Becky's correct that this budget does fix some things, but it also includes a lot of setbacks for North Carolinians. You know, we all want to put the budget on a sustainable path, but this budget or I guess legislators handed us a budget that puts the train on the wrong tracks. It finances tax cuts for millionaires and finances them with deep cuts to services and programs that North Carolinians really care about. We heard earlier about the cost of growth for Medicaid really driving the budget this year. And I think that's a little bit misleading because healthcare costs are growing regardless if it's Medicaid, Medicare, or private healthcare insurance. So the ability of state lawmakers to be able to control Medicaid is just all of it's not within their control. But if we look at the big picture, this budget does increase spending about 2% over the base budget, which is what's needed to maintain current service levels. But if you take a deeper look, it cuts more than $480 million from public education, community colleges, and the UNC system. It also funds well below what's needed in other areas of the budget. So I think that, you know, when we look at this budget, it is a clear set of choices, and because it is linked to the tax cut plan that they proposed, Becky said that it cuts taxes. It does reduce it drains available revenues by more than $520 million. And those aren't just numbers on a sheet of paper. Those are, as you spoke to Dave about earlier, those are that results in higher class sizes, fewer teachers and teachers' assistants. It higher tuition rates are included in this budget, and that will push families deeper into debt. It means scarcer economic development resources for our distressed communities. You talk about communities in the Black Belt of North Carolina, where African American population, or I'm sorry, unemployment rates are more than double what the state unemployment rate is, and this budget reduces the Commerce State Aid budget by more than half. So if you really want to fix, if this budget is about fixing things, it doesn't fix a lot of things. It actually makes several things worse.
Well, let me ask you about that. Let's stick with Medicaid for a minute. The state lawmakers turned away tens of millions of dollars, and which means that half a million North Carolinians are not eligible for, you know, Medicaid medical services that they would have been. That money would get spent in the state. Can't we fix the program? You're not going to contain the cost, or can you, in the state of North Carolina, simply by not taking the money and spending it back into the economy? Can you do both at the same time and still allow people to receive those services?
I would argue, Frank, there is no such thing as free money. And this program that the federal government offered to pay for those Medicaid expenses for 3 years, but not after that. Now, while the legislature and this governor were debating about whether or not to expand Medicaid, there were audits coming out of Auditor Beth Wood's office that indicated hundreds of millions of dollars are being wasted, misused, very little cost containment in Medicaid. And so they made what I believe is the right decision, is why would you expand a program that is badly broken? We need to fix that. We also need to not obligate. This is one reason why the state's gotten in the mess that they have, is over the years we have obligated ourselves to things that we can't afford, obligated ourselves to things that we don't know how much it's going to cost. So it's a different way of looking at things. It's a different priority. And, you know, along those lines, these cuts and the level of government, I think, is a lot of what we're talking about. What we're trying to find, and what's always the challenge, what is the right level of government? And so I think some of the people who are complaining about the cutbacks and the reduction, the rolling back of government, the assumption is that the current level of government, or the level of government 2 years ago, was the right level of government. I would argue that it isn't, that we're getting closer to what I believe is the right level of government from which we then need to work.
Dave, where there's been certainly a clear shift in priorities and direction is in public education, away from public education and more toward privatized education. And along those lines, an expansion in charter schools, an expansion in vouchers. What kind of accountability and oversight, how does that change to make sure that the quality of education goes along with this competition that's supposed to bring better education? Are more people going to be hired to make sure that the charter schools and private schools are actually accountable to the standards of North Carolina?
Yeah, this budget does include three new positions, consultant positions they're called, that would go work in the Office of Charter Schools, that would presumably go and help supervise the influx of charter schools that's occurring. Now, anybody who's spent time with the folks who work in the Office of Charter Schools knows that they're pretty overworked right now, and adding three will help, but it won't make it a situation where there's going to be a lot more oversight. And just philosophically, charter schools are designed not to have as much oversight and supervision as traditional public schools. They're given a lot more leeway to, you know, the original law intended them to be really learning laboratories, to try new things and to take some of those new things that they figure out and work and take those to the larger traditional public schools. Now, that's gotten away from that in the, you know, more decade plus that the charter schools have been in play here in North Carolina. There isn't a whole lot of that going on because this wall has been set up between the charter school establishment and the traditional public school establishment. There's not a lot of trust that goes on there. And there are people who are trying to make that better. But certainly, even in this less government philosophy of the current legislature, they did see the need to add some positions to the Office of Charter Schools here in North Carolina to help with the backlog and help with the you know, even just the paperwork, let alone going out and visiting these schools and helping to make them better.
Tazer, what about that, the shift in direction away from public education and toward private schools?
You know, at the Justice Center, we think that that is very problematic. And when you zoom in and you look at these vouchers, there's no evidence of student achievement with voucher programs. In fact, in jurisdictions that have had vouchers the longest, those in those areas, public school students outperform voucher students on proficiency exams. And really, we should be asking our question, or asking the question of, do we really want to be educating low-income students on the cheap? And that's exactly what vouchers do. They provide it costs less to do vouchers than it does to educate kids in the public school system. But if I could jump back to Becky's comment about the appropriate level of government, we have to realize that even under this the final budget deal, state spending would be below the four-decade average of state spending as a share of the economy. And we also have to remember that there's a lot of ground to be regained since the deep and enduring cuts that have been enacted after the Great Recession. North Carolina's population is growing. Healthcare costs are growing, like we just discussed. The cost of educating our kids, that's also growing. So whenever you enact a tax plan that chips away at available revenues, while your population is growing, then it's very problematic for what's needed to actually maintain. And I don't come up with the numbers of what's needed. You know, the Office of State Budget and Management puts out a continuation budget, which says this is what's needed to maintain adequate service levels. But instead of investing adequate resources in schools and the other strong and enduring building blocks of a strong economy, they chose to enact tax cuts that primarily benefit the wealthiest, while also allowing the earned income tax credit to expire, which enables low-income people to stay in the workforce, yeah, and really provide for their families.
Well, let me ask you more, Becky, about this theory of less government, because at a time when the state was spending ever more on education, as you said, it became more than 50% of the state's overall budget. Last year, for the first time in 12 years, last year, the state's dropout rate leveled off, and that was after increased spending and when the state's relative pay for teachers went to 23rd from like 44th. So in a sense, government spending can at least correlate with one positive outcome. It's not like it was all wasted. And I guess the question is there a place for government spending? Did it prove its worth, and why would you change that? Why would you go from 23rd to 44th?
Well, the 23rd to 24th is a relative figure. I mean, that's compared to other states. And it also doesn't include things like cost of living, other benefits. North Carolina teachers get very generous benefits, socials. And I'm not complaining about that. That's just the fact of it. You know, also, we have a relatively young teacher workforce, if you will, and our pay scale is based on experience. So when you compare those averages, there's a lot of things to be taken into consideration with that. There's some assumptions there, Frank, that I'm just not sure that I agree with. The overall spending for North Carolina, Tazer mentioned that you know, our $20 billion budget is actually a $50 billion budget. You know, so when you only pull one part of that out, the $20 billion is the general fund spending on state needs. When you put in federal money, other reserves, other avenues that we have, you know, our budget actually exceeds $50 billion, and that has increased. Now, the proportion between state general fund spending and federal spending has that gap has widened, which creates creates another problem that we can talk about on another day. But, you know, some of those figures, you really have – some of the figures may not be as meaningful as others are when you look at the whole picture. To find that level of government in education, this is something – you know, again, in this budget, 56% of this budget goes for education. Mm-hmm. So, again, it is a high priority here in North Carolina. And over the – DPI, the Department of Public Instruction, has published numbers saying that the graduation rate is going up. And while they're complaining that teachers aren't getting paid enough. So in essence, what a lot of studies show is there's not a direct correlation between pay and performance.
Well, I have to say it went up. That's a 12-year process, right? I mean, graduation rates don't happen on the year. You know, you don't get an improvement that year, right? I mean, that's the result of 12 years of progress. And that was the time at which we were 23rd, not 44th. So, I have to say, in fairness, and again, relative, when, I mean, certainly people were very concerned about being 44th on the tax rate. When taxes were high relative to our neighbors, people were very concerned about that and said, we're not competitive. Our businesses won't be competitive. They won't come here. Wouldn't the same thing happen to teachers if we're 44th in pay? Aren't we chasing them out?
Well,
and when things improved, when we were much higher relative to our neighbors over that 12-year period, doesn't that tell us something about the need for government spending?
I'm not sure about that. You know, and I'm not sure that teacher pay is the only thing that teachers are concerned about. You know, a lot of the paperwork, a lot of the extra things that they are required to do with federal regulations. You know, something else, just another point in this education budget that we've seen is Common Core is something that I believe you all have talked about on this show before. One of the provisions in the budget requires that the General Assembly will take a look at all the testing before any Common Core is implemented in North Carolina. With the tenure program, there's been a lot of discussion about that. You know, what that is being replaced with is it's more of a performance-based evaluation. Those teachers who meet the highest criteria of a four-year contract will get additional pay. So what we're moving towards is rather than this cookie cutter, everybody gets the same, whether you're an exemplary teacher or whether you're somebody who is just kind of shows up to get the job done each day, those teachers that are performing better are going to be paid better.
Let's talk about the Rural Center for a moment. Tazra, let me ask you about that. It was certainly in the papers, a lot of reporting about apparent irregularities there. The head of that, the Rural Center, was forced to step down. Was it time for the Rural Center to end?
You know, I don't think that's for me to answer, but I know that the audit that did come out and, you know, the NNO articles that reviewed some of the practices of the Rural Center really gave legislators some grave concern to look into their operations. And, you know, in this budget, they completely stripped the authority of the Rural Center to operate and what that will mean for rural communities that are distressed and lagging behind their more urban counterparts is yet to be seen. And you spoke about this earlier, whether or not state lawmakers will honor the grants that the Rural Center promised to these struggling economies. You know, our hope is that that distressed communities will still get some of still get the help that they need. But another concerning part of the commerce budget is that all of the cuts to the commerce state aid, recurring funding is completely eliminated for the Institute of Minority Economic Development, which includes the Women's Business Center. It's eliminated for the Community Development Corporations, the NC Indian Economic Development Initiative, and others. They do create this new division that's funded, I think, about $11.3 million recurring. That's less than what the Rural Center received. However, that division will have some grant-making authority, and it will be designed to promote job creation. But whenever you eliminate the Rural Center and you eliminate all of these community programs that work locally in these struggling communities, you know, the impact is clear that this really does shift economic development away from distressed communities and towards larger corporations and businesses.
But the big question is, was it really working? Becky?
Well, yeah, and I would disagree with that. I don't think that it shifts it away from the distressed in the rural communities at all. What you're doing is they're taking the money from the Rural Center and they're putting it back where there is oversight, where there's measurements in place so we can see what they're doing. One of the big problems with the Rural Economic Development Center was there were measures not put in place as to whether or not that money was being well spent. So again, to my point, one of the themes that we see running through this budget is fixing things. And some of the programs that Tazra has mentioned need a second look. Just because government has funded something once or over a period of years doesn't mean that we don't need to go back and make sure that that money is being used the best that it can possibly be used. Maybe some consolidation, maybe taking some things from out of these nonprofit organizations, putting them back into the umbrella where there's closer oversight, more coordination, cost savings for the taxpayer, and better services. This whole reorganization of the Commerce Department, which was rolled into the budget, we had some discussion about it. It looks like it is going to go forward. Part of that is refocusing how commerce and business development and economic incentives and economic development is done in North Carolina so that it is more regional-based. Those distressed areas will get the benefits of being in close proximity to some of the better economic areas. So this whole reorganization is not abandoning anything. It's making it, it's an effort to make it work better.
Tazra?
Well, I think that certainly oversight is needed when we're talking about state tax dollars. Every household in North Carolina pays taxes and they deserve to know where their tax dollars are going. But there's no guarantee that, you know, all of the 12 or so nonprofits who, and I'm not only talking about the Rural Center, I'm talking about these other nonprofits where there hasn't been a record, at least, you know, spoken among legislative circles, like what happened to the Rural Center. So I don't disagree with oversight, but this, there's really no guarantee that these distressed communities will get as much attention
and
state dollars.
I would argue that, as Tazra mentioned, in many of these distressed areas, the unemployment rate is double or more of what it is on the national average. There's a problem there. If these groups were doing such a great job, perhaps we would have seen more advancement and more things coming forward. So maybe it's time to take another look at it, see if we can get this working better.
There's the history. I mean, there's a history. If you look at historical disinvestment and especially the Black Belt area. So there is a decades-long problem. It's not just a recent problem when we look at these distressed
communities. Tazra Mitchell, a fellow at the North Carolina Justice Center, Becky Gray, Vice President for Outreach at the John Locke Foundation, and Dave DeWitt, our Raleigh Bureau Chief. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks.
There's more ahead. Stay tuned.